All right, since we're still in the warm-up phase of this conference, I thought I'd start with a general overview picture, essentially how we think the Milky Way forms, at least if you come from the cosmologist's point of view. Essentially, you have some Z field, you have some amplifying mechanism to grow structure, which is gravity. We have this nasty astrophysics, which transforms baryons into stars and feeds back energy to the interstellar medium. And at the end, we hope to get out the Hubble sequence. So essentially, that is a kind of equation system we are trying to solve. And well, how far did we get? And I leave it to Chris Brooks in the afternoon to show you a couple of movies. I just want to show two slides here. The one showing how structure grows in this dark matter, fluid in quotation marks, and the last plot down here has zoomed in. So here you have a panel size of about 40 kiloparsec, whereas here you're more like 500 kiloparsec co-moving. So essentially the message is you grow structure, larger and larger lumps at the center, and end up with a fairly compact dark matter halo. On the other side, if you look at gas can dissipate energy, therefore you don't get spheroidal structures, you're getting disc-like structures. Dissipation of energy essentially results in the gas that you end up with a flat, angular momentum-supported disc structure. Well, so far in theory, in practice, it works very well if you are not coming too close to the screen and just look at it with a grain of salt. Essentially, you are able to get the main components of a galaxy. You get a disk out of gas and of young stars. You get a spheroidal component out of old stars. So you get a composite, which kind of looks okay, but if you really try to estimate the disk to bulge ratio from these plots, you're at best getting an SC, S0, or maybe an SA type galaxy. And this is a kind of a problem that is plaguing us for quite a while. Essentially, nature tells you you have either galaxies that are disk-like and blue, or spheroidal and red. And if you simulate things, you get things that are spheroidal and blue. So we have to change something. And that is usually addressed to the effects of feedback. Feedback in the 2000s plays the same role as magnetic fields in the 1970s. So everything you don't understand, you account to the effects of feedback. Showing here is a fake image of a model galaxy. In its simplest case, no feedback at all. So you just transform gas into stars and let the energy owing to supernova, stellar winds, and so on, radiate away. If you do the same and reinvest the energy into the interstellar medium, you see that you can get decently sized disk components. So these are fake HST type images of this model galaxy. And just using the same cosmologic initial conditions, just playing on the feedback dial. And of course, you also can overdo it if you add too much feedback, you're ending with disks which have no bulge at all, which is good. But on the other hand side, you're getting disks which are puffed up quite substantially. So the problem we have is we have a scenario which overall looks reasonably well, but in order to get it work, you really have to fine-tune it. But the question really is, can we find, ideally, based on physical description, a parameterized description for how the interstellar medium acts, which essentially minimizes your degrees of freedom in fine-tuning. Well, if you're happy with rather than trying to model at best a model like the galaxy, but go one step back and say, well, let's just look at the processes that are acting. So we may get the process and the mix of the processes wrong within a factor of 2 or 3, but each individual process tells us something. If we compare it with the data, you actually can learn quite a bit out of the simulations. For example, one result is quite naturally, you get out of the simulation kind of two-component structure for the disk. you're getting a disk which has two vertical scale lengths, a thin disk and a thick disk. You see that in surface density. You also can look at velocity dispersion. You see essentially here the old stellar component has a high velocity dispersion, whereas the young stellar component has a low velocity dispersion. Or you can look, where do these stars form that we find in these different components? And you find that all the stars that you find in the thin disk component are essentially formed in the disk. So gas is accreted and transformed into stars. But if you go to the older components of stars, so stars 8 gigayears old and older, and look where they are formed, they form away from the galaxy. So the typical fate of such a star is it forms in a satellite, and the satellite later on gets accreted and added to the disk. You also can try to investigate, well, do we get a handle on the origin of different stellar populations? Essentially, take the galaxy as it is at the end of the simulation, look at all the stars, and trace them back where did they form from. And then look at the stars, for example, and compare them to the initial distribution of the gas. And for example, look at the stars that you find in the bulge component of a galaxy, or look at the stars you find in the disk component of a galaxy. The basic message, for example, is that the stars you find nowadays in the bulge of the Milky Way, for example, formed at the highest density peaks of this early density fluctuation field. Whereas if you look at the stars that nowadays you find in the disk component, they essentially come from everywhere. There also seems to be a systematic link between population of stars at the present day and the level of fluctuations in the density field. Well, if you now keep in mind this picture I just showed you, that a galaxy is continuously being built up by a sequence of mergers, you may ask the question, well, how is it in reality if you look at the Milky Way? And there has been an increasing number of detections of events that are typical for some, say, accretion event, merging event for our Milky Way. The most famous one is probably just the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy that essentially showed the galaxy eats up stuff. Monoceros stream, globular clusters like Palomar 5. You see something similar for our neighbor galaxy, Andromeda, the Andromeda stream. You can start arguing whether some of the kinematical groups you find in the disk of the Milky Way are also signatures of accretion events, or whether they're dynamical resonances, or some groups are the one or other groups are the others, like, for example, the eigenmoving groups. Omega Centaurus, usually labeled a globular cluster, may also be a disrupted dwarf elliptical galaxy. Substructure in the galactic disk I already mentioned. And the big question, we are, I think, now at the level to answer this modern astronomical surveys, is do we have more than anecdotal evidence for something happens to the Milky Way? Milky Way is accreting occasionally stuff towards a picture where the Milky Way is systematically has been built up by accretion events. So I think the final proof that the Milky Way has been, if that's true, of course, that the Milky Way has been systematically being built up by accretion events is still to be shown. So I think at a moment we have a number of examples that are pointing toward the Korean picture, but the final proof still needs to be done. And what needs to be done is to firm up the prediction from the models, to strengthen the case for the Milky Way, and to look at other galaxies. And that is essentially the program you find in, say, if you look at the galaxy type of proposals on pretty much every major telescope, one of those two, strengthen the case for the Milky Way or show it for other galaxy, is high on the agenda. Well, also keep in mind, if you take the average astronomy textbook, open the chapter Milky Way, and look what's in this chapter, it tells you the Milky Way formed 10 billion years ago and pretty much did nothing after that, except forming stars. And there are good arguments in this direction, and I'm pretty sure that these arguments for and against that will be repeatedly revisited during this conference and during the whole workshop program. So the disk of the Milky Way is thin, arguing against substantial accretion, at least at the level of the disk. If you look at the solar neighborhood of stars within this kinematics, you find stars older than 10 billion years. So how that, if the galaxy is continuously being merged up and messed up by mergers? The overall thin disk looks like a very coherent system of ordered motion. So it's kind of difficult to understand how in a system where the galaxy forms up by merger, such an ordered motion results at the end, even if you have the gas physics as an aid. And finally, if you look at the stellar population of Milky Way satellites, at least in their chemical abundance properties, that's systematically different to the stellar population, say, in the Milky Way, for example, in the halo of the Milky Way. That's certainly something one has to understand. However, on the other hand side, many galaxies are lopsided, maybe 50% or more. And these, to create these features and have them, or warped, and to create these features and have them long living is not easy. And a much simpler explanation is that they're relatively short-lived but are continuously re-excited, for example, by merging events. So that brings me to this kind of pessimistic slide, like in the introductory talk, what do we really know about the Milky Way? And even if you look at the global properties of the Milky Way as a cosmological object, we have actually quite substantial uncertainties. We don't really know what the mass or potential depth of the galactic potential is. There's a bit of discussion later on. I will add some fuel to the fire in a few minutes. Is the escape velocity, or the circular velocity, 200 kilometers, 150 kilometers per second, 100 kilometers per second? I would argue that is the range of uncertainties we have. Is the halo spherical, triaxial, prolate, oblate? Many arguments pointing in the one or the other direction. What's the scale length of the disk? Even there, we are uncertain, at least at the level of 50% or so. Is there at all a clear thin disk, thick disk? Certainly some people, Rosy, certainly in the afternoon, will strongly argue in that direction. Other people may argue more like in a continuous transition. Substructures, as I mentioned, are that really signs of a systematic effect, or is it just anecdotal events? At this conference, we certainly will also address the number of satellites, whether that causes a problem. And at the end, the answer to all of these questions is related to one major question. Is the Milky Way a typical galaxy of its luminosity? Because you find, for example, if you take some of the data, you would come to the conclusion that the Milky Way is rather untypical. So there are a number of surveys now in process, in design, or have already started and collected data, photometric surveys as well as spectroscopic surveys, who either by design from the beginning or later on, or found it's helpful, addresses the question, how has Milky Way been built up? And the major change owing to the survey is that we really have a well-controlled selection function. We start with a sample of stars, and then can analyze the stars, draw well-defined subsample of stars, and analyze that, rather than observing some stars because they just happen to be available on that night, and you look at that. And there are also some, when you have sparse sample of data, some sociological effects. You know that from physicists have a plot with 2 points and say, oh, how interesting, I have a linear relation. And if astronomers have 2 points, they say, oh, how interesting, I have 2 populations. So the one survey I'm got involved in a bit more, and I just want to detail a bit more on, is RAVE. Then it was a radio velocity experiment, which is a spectroscopic high latitude survey of the Milky Way. It aims at the relatively bright stars, I band magnitudes between 9 and 13. It looks at the Gaia spectral range and with a comparable resolution. So you have a relatively narrow spectral range of 8400 to 8800, but have a relatively high resolution in this area of about an average resolution of 7,500. RAVE is in operation since 2003. If funding goes well, it will continue to observe till the end of 2011 using the 6DF multi-object spectrograph at the UK Schmidt telescope. 6DF obviously stands for 6-degree field of view. And prior to August 2005, we had 7 nights per month available to observe. And since August 2005, we are the sole operator of the telescope, observing between 20 and 25 nights per month and collecting data. And that, with an average number of 700, 800, 900 stars we can observe in a good night, comes to the conclusion, if you integrate it up, that you end up with about a 1 million spectra throughout the running time of the survey. And the project makes public data releases essentially on a yearly schedule. Just earlier this year, published in July 2008, we released the second data release of RAVE, so the first 2 years of data collection covering 6,800 square degrees on the galactic sky. So far we have about 52,000 radio velocities published for 49,000 targets in the survey. And that's new in the second data release compared to the first one. For 22,000 of these spectra, we could use stellar parameters. So right now we are working on DR3, which is scheduled to be released mid of next year. And in DR3, we will have about 88,000 radio velocities on 79,000 objects and stellar parameters for about 52,000 stars. So with that, and of course DR4 already in the pipeline, we are right now having the largest database of stellar parameters available. It's also a very interesting source of stellar parameters. This shows where we are in data collection. So as of earlier this month, we have collected about 320,000 spectra for 300,000 stars, which are all already reduced at the first level, but still have to go through the rest of the pipeline. You're getting radio velocities with an average accuracy of about 1 kilometer per second. Well, the other big survey in that direction is, of course, the Sloan survey, which is a combination of a photometric and a spectroscopic survey. And one result by Eric Bell and collaborators was to actually ask the question, is it anecdotal evidence or not? Do we really, at least if we go to the outer halo of the Milky Way, see systematically that the Milky Way has been built up by mergers? Or do we see substructure? And this is shown here in distance cuts for the photometric data of the Sloan survey based on DR5 data. And then Eric tried to model a kind of triaxial power law to these models and took the residuals. And essentially, all the residuals have substantial signature, in particular if you go to larger distances of some substructure. And this is quantified in this plot here and compared to a set of models by Bullock and Johnson, shown here. And this is a typical, say, degree of fluctuations if you go to the outer halo of the Milky Way. If you go to the Milky Way halo at, say, 30 kiloparsec and larger, and compare that simulation to observation. So from this data, really points towards that indeed the outer halo of the Milky Way is. That is the fluctuation. I don't know the filter function at offhand. I would. And I'm sure the next talk will address these issues at some more detail. Well, where if we did the following question rather than looking at the distant halo, looking at the solar neighborhood in the question, is there a vertical stream in the solar neighborhood? And the simple test to check for that is essentially a symmetry check. So the Milky Way locally should be axisymmetric. So if you have a stream going through that, you have an even parity signal and an uneven parity background, and should be easily detectable. Essentially, Judge Siegberg, his PhD thesis, did this analysis based on Rafe stars and the stars from the Geneva-Copenhagen survey, and came to the conclusion that there is no sign of a large-scale motion in the solar neighborhood as it would be produced, for example, by the Sagittarius stream or by the Virgo overdensity. This picks out all stars in the solar neighborhood. So no preselection for halo stars. Well, we had a bit of a discussion on the escape velocity. So let me detail a bit what we did and also compare that directly to what we did with the Sloan database. Essentially, the idea is you're looking at the high velocity and of the velocity distribution of stars in the solar neighborhood, model them by a power law, and then try to model this energy distribution by a stellar system sitting in an NFW type of potential. And if you do this exercise and assume an NFW dark halo that has been adiabatically contracted by the baryons that are sitting in that halo potential, to come to the conclusion that we have an escape velocity of 550 kilometers per second, or if you translate it in a virial velocity at the edge, in quotation mark, of the dark matter halo, meaning about 200 kiloparsec, of 140 kilometers per second, or a total Milky Way mass of about 1.4 times 10 to 12 solar masses. But the interesting fact is that this number is considerably smaller than what you would get for the typical halo that hosts the Milky Way if you see semi-analytical models of from a cosmological point of view, who more argue going into the direction of 200 kilometers per second. However, one should note, there's one caveat here. This argument, or this escape velocity, assumes that you fill all the available velocity up to the escape velocity. There's no physical reason that this needs to be the case. If you look at the simulation, like those I showed you in the first few diagrams, then indeed we see that in the simulation, that the velocity space is essentially filled up to escape velocity. But in a strict physical sense, what we derive here is not an escape velocity, but a lower bound on the escape velocity. The escape velocity could even be higher. But this is a comparison with the Sloan data from the thesis of Zhangyang Zhu, showing the escape velocity based on Sloan BHB stars probing the halo to much larger distances. If you are in the solar neighborhood, and that's reassuring, you find the same value, even though you have fairly different analysis techniques, you find the same value for the Rafe stars as well as for the Sloan stars. But what Zhang did also is actually really try to measure a rotation curve, a circular velocity curve, using the rotation velocity and the dispersion of the BHB sample, and comes essentially to the same conclusion, a virial mass of the order of about 10 to 12 solar masses. Or if you translate it in virial velocity, again, 140 kilometers per second. Now, at least for this argument, that caveat with the escape velocity I just mentioned is not holding. So it would be marginally bound, or marginally unbound. It would be just at the edge. But I come to the plot Julio just mentioned when we discussed the high velocity stars. What we did here, took the Brown et al. Samples, plot the distance of the star, galactocentric distance, versus galactocentric radial velocity, of those stars are coming to the color in a few seconds. Just look at the velocity you find. And if you take what, for example, would be the cosmological prediction for an Milky Way potential, so that the Milky Way is as abundant as typical galaxy of that magnitude, you find only one of the stars in the prominent sample would actually be unbound. Most of the stars would be bound to the gravitational potential. If you take the value we found from the escape velocity argument, it would lie somewhere about here. About half of the stars in the grounded R sample would be unbound. The other half still would be bound to the Milky Way halo. Yeah? Essentially, that you get galaxies, that you're essentially getting L stars, L star galaxies as abundant as L stars. And fits the Tully-Fisher relation at the same time, kind of finding the best compromise between abundance of galaxy of a certain brightness and Tully-Fisher zero point. Well, what we also did in that plot, we color encode the stars by, say, their travel time to the galactic center, blue meaning stars of about 120 mega years, and then looking at that stars in EITOF protection. And we found it interesting that most of these stars of the same travel time are now essentially the same part of the sky. So that let us made look into some of the simulation I showed you at the beginning of my talk and looked at that for the very same effect. And essentially what you find is occasionally you have a satellite that is being disrupted, partly disrupted, by the gravitational potential. And when this coming flying by and it's moving out again, in this diagram, the stars essentially fall on a line of constant travel time, as shown here in red. In particular, I show here the escape velocity for that very dark matter halo. And actually, a few stars even exceed the escape velocity. And the reason is, essentially, you disrupt the star by the halo by falling in. So you're getting two tidal arms. The one tidal arm loses angular momentum. The other gains angular momentum. The tidal arm that gains angular momentum just kicked. If you have a fairly radial orbit, that kicked in close to the escape velocity. So at least a proposal, we just put in a letter, which is in this, that we're working on the answer on the referee report right now, is that there's at least an alternative mechanism to explain at least some of the high-velocity stars. So the high-velocity stars are not kicked out by black holes at the center, at least some of them, but essentially the remnant of an accreted satellite. Actually, if you then have a tile like that and are essentially aligned in your position to the sun to that stream, you essentially find all the stars in the same quadrant or the same area. The night sky, just because you're looking along the tidal stream. Well, I have to rush over a few more results we got with Rafe. Galactic potential, a tilt of the velocity ellipsoid, essentially measuring the velocity ellipsoid of the Milky Way. And with that, the tilt gives you an indication of the asphericity of the galactic potential. So what we measure with the first 2 years of Rafe data is a tilt of about 7.3 degree, plus minus 1.8 degrees. And if you plot that in a map with the galaxy models by Binet and Tremaine, there's a the extreme models, the one a relative compact disk of 2 kilopascals, the other one a relative large disk with scale lengths of 3.2 galaxies. That would be the error bar from our escape from our tilt of the velocity argument. Right now, we are not in a situation where we really can strengthen the determination of the parameters. But the main message is, if we're working with a full data set, we're certainly getting this error bar down. Then we really can refine the model of the Milky Way. I skip over this one and want to go to abundances in the Rafe survey at the end. So as I said, Rafe looks at a very narrow range in the spectrum, 84 to 8800 calcium triplet. There are a number of weak metal lines in the spectral range. So what we did is we wrote a pipeline who actually is determining abundances from this very area of the spectrum, plus stellar parameters we took from a fitting the spectrum with template spectra. So getting stellar parameters by fitting the Rafe spectrum with a template library, and then using set stellar parameters and the measured equivalent widths to deduct abundances. And this is shown here for a sample of comparison stars we used, essentially the sample compiled by Zubiron and Girard. We plot the Zubiron abundance on the one axis, and we plot the Rafe measured abundance on the other axis. And the basic message is that the whole thing works surprisingly well. We're getting, for stars we have, so right now it works for signal-to-noise better than 50 or so, and I think we certainly can reduce that threshold by fine-tuning the pipeline, getting errors at the level of 0.2 dex. And essentially, then you can look at trends, look at element X versus iron over hydrogen. Essentially, you can look at the same trends, for example, and can compare it directly with the Zubiron and Girard sample, only with the difference that here we have about 30,000 stars in that map. And this is just from DR1 and DR2. Whereas here, we're having of the order of a few thousand stars. So certainly, with the full Rafe data base online, we will increase the sample by at least 1.5 orders of magnitude. And then you really can start doing nice experiments using your sample. And then you're taking well-defined kinematic thresholds. For example, we used a very conservative or very extreme discrimination between thin disk and thick disk by saying thin disk stars are stars with velocities less than 20 kilometers per second and within 0.3 kiloparsec of the galactic disk, whereas thick disk stars, we use stars which have W of larger than 50 kilometers per second and rotation velocity lag less than 100 kilometers. So two fairly extreme definitions of thin disk and thick disk, and then can look at systematic changes in the abundances between those two populations. So that's work in progress, just a kind of teaser what we will be able to do with the database in the near future. So that brings me to my summary. So I think there's still considerable uncertainties with respect to the basic parameters of our Milky Way. We don't know the global mass of the Milky Way better than a factor of 3 or 4. I also showed that hierarchical scenarios provide you some nice explanation, generic explanation for a number of effects you observe in the Milky Way. Others issues still remain. I mentioned these, for example, the systematic differences in the abundances between satellite galaxies and halo stars in the Milky Way. There is no strong reason why they should be identical in the CDM type scenario, but we nevertheless have to explain in detail the observed differences between those two populations of stars. I think there's a really increasing evidence for mergers or substructure in the halo of our Milky Way in the outer areas of the galaxy. And I think with the next generation of survey, and now I'm playing the optimist, things will change. Thank you.
Okay, questions? There's something I don't understand about the discussion of hypervelocity stars, including what Scott talked about. For some years, it has been reported that there are pulsars that have space velocities that are in excess of 1,000 kilometers a second. Now, the origin of these pulsars are almost certainly from the disk. So, number one, how, if this is the case, how can these hypervelocity stars be telling us anything about the galactic potential?
Well, I think in particular for these pulsars, there's a question whether that is not caused by asymmetry in the explosion mechanism of the supernovae. So I think for the pulsars, it would be really difficult to account them to detail, except to use the kinematic signature you have in those pulsars to improve the model of the disk.
All right, so I'm Warren Brown, the fellow who found these things. The hypervelocity stars, the pulsars are remnants of stars that exploded in supernova. The stars, the hypervelocity stars, are all main sequence stars, to the best of our knowledge. Yeah. Four have been proven to be main sequence stars. Runaway star mechanisms are bound by the physics of stellar dimensions. You can't get to these unbound ejection speeds with stars. You have to invoke a more massive and compact object. Otherwise, you merge. Physically possible to have a binary encounter in which the best ejection speed could be the escape velocity of the most massive star. But in that case, you need to invoke, 50, 100 solar mass stars and have binary encounters involving them. And the estimated rate that Scott and you had done was about once in a Hubble time you'd expect, 1,000 kilometers per second ejection from that kind of process. The central black hole should have a much more larger rate of hypervelocity star ejections. But I guess I had a comment and a question. One is the escape velocity. I'd never seen an estimate that large for the Milky Way. I think that doesn't counter the explanation for these objects. The central black holes eject stars on a range of velocities, unbound and bound, and we don't see the stars falling onto the galaxy at minus 500 kilometers per second. So that says they're short-lived. This is something that Andy and Juna had published, and we've pointed out as well. And spectroscopy shows that, in fact, four of them are certainly main-sequence stars. So that means these things had to have been born about a couple hundred million years ago. In this case,
the model would be essentially that this close encounter of the Milky Way. I mean, this 120 million years is exactly travel time to the closest encounter. And we know, at least from merging galaxies, that encounters can trigger star formation. So you would need a mechanism like that. So
this has to be a star-forming dwarf with gas.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the nice thing about the proposal is that it's falsifiable. Really, this additional information can tell whether it works or works for some stars, or doesn't work at all for that reason.
But here's on your summary sheet, you had said the global mass of the Milky Way is still uncertain to a factor of 3 to 4. To which extent does the uncertainty come from a unclear or inhomogeneous definition of what the global mass is? That is, if you were to go to the mass enclosed in operative definition, 50 or 200 kiloparsecs, how much do the uncertainties shrink then?
I think when you really ask the question within 50 kiloparsecs, the uncertainties would shrink quite substantially.
So, Matthias, I've always thought the Abadi et al. 2003 paper was really fun with the accreted thick disk, but I never got a sense of, the first question I would ask is, that was one example. So if you look at 100 different disks, do you always get your thick disk accreted? And because it just seemed very unlikely. So you can answer that in simulation space, right?
Yeah, so it's essentially at that set of simulations, we now have a set of about 10 simulations. We find in each one this thin disk and thick disk at different ratios.
Matthias?
Yeah.
The question with the satellite. Question with the satellite. Surely the disk provides a constraint on this satellite that had to get quite close to the center of the galaxy and yet not be massive enough to mess up the disk. And we don't see it. So what mass would you say that satellite?
Well, I think the interesting question is really, we may hear more about that later this week from Julio and Mike Cullen, from the n-body only simulation, there's also not clear what is really the survival rate. I think at the end is the survival rate of substructure when they're getting close to the disk. So how compact are they and how well do they survive these close encounters? And that will tell you what the heating rate is.
So if it was making B stars quite recently, wouldn't you think there'd be some gas left over?
On that stream, probably, yeah.
Have you looked in high-velocity cloud maps?
Yeah.
So your 7.3 degree velocity ellipsoid measurement was in the plane of the...
But 300 parsec above the plane of the Milky Way.
It's there, but which way does it point? It's in the direction of the plane, or how is the...
It points towards the, towards the plane.
Okay, so I should just mention that I got, you know, 0 ± 2 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wondered why you, you know, if you were looking at only halo stars for this population, why you didn't look at only halo stars for the vertical velocity motion.
Stars 300 parsec. Stars 300 parsec above the plane, so dominated by halo stars.
No, I don't.
It's 300 parsec.
Oh no.
I
was measuring halo stars, and I have all three angles, and they're all zero. And, right.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Any more questions?
Just a quick comment. I just wanted to say that the proper motion information that we're going to be getting about these hypervelocity stars and also the mass function. So, you know, Warren's just found some A stars, and in the Sloan survey, we're working hard to find F and G stars. Will actually be a really nice discriminant of sort of ejection models or these stream things.
Any more? Okay, well, let's thank Michelle for coming.